Welcome to Just an Average Citizen, the podcast that helps to educate, inform, and empower you to make an impact in Abilene and the Big Country. Thank you so much for joining me for this episode of Book by the By. I am so excited to share this book with you, and I did take a little break last week on the official week of spring break because I wanted to make sure everyone who was available could follow along. And of course, I know these podcasts are recorded, so you can listen and watch anytime you want, but I just wanted to make sure that we didn't miss some people by putting this out during a kind of a big time of travel for a lot of people. So this week is really going to be jam-packed with a lot of great information. It's one that I believe I read this book twice last year because it came out in June and it was just so powerful. I wanted to make sure I gathered all that there was that the toxic war on masculinity had to offer. It's called How Christianity Reconciles the Sexes by Nancy Piercy. And so it'd really help me if you would subscribe and share this with your family and friends so they too could understand how to battle well the cultural endeavors we have to face here in the city and in the big country, because this is very relevant for what we're trying to do to restore our community back to what we believe God had created it to be. And so it's really helpful if you can let other people know about it. I'm always amazed, partly because I probably don't talk about it as much as I should, but there are people who don't even know that I do a podcast. And so I'm trying to get the word out, and it's still a little out of my comfort zone because you know who am I? I'm just a regular lady just trying to do life and seek what the Lord would have us to do to make an impact in our city and our area. And it's been a journey, to say the least. So these are less bites probably than they should have been originally. I really wanted to get these done, but there's just so much important, culturally relevant information for what we're dealing with in our city that I just wanted to really give you as much as I could within a reasonable amount of time. And so Nancy Piercy is one of those authors that I will read anything she publishes because she is just so profound in her research and her presentation. And she is so smart. Man, she makes me smarter just by reading her books. But the first book I read of hers was Saving Leonardo. It was powerful. Talked about how our children are being influenced and how worldview matters. And then the next book I read was Love Thy Body, which was a great book pre-queer theory, where she talked about when we separate the body from the soul, then we live lives less than what God intended us to. And so it's easy to destroy our bodies when we don't understand that they too were created in God's image. And then, you know, there's just all these different books. I've loved every book that she's written. And she teaches in Houston at Houston Baptist University, and she has the opportunity. You can audit her classes. I haven't been able to yet, but man, that would be something I would love to get to do. So I'm really excited when she came out with this one, because she mentioned this a little bit in Total Truth, and it blew my mind how negative the industrial age affected the family. And I don't think we really understand the impact it had, because we've only known life post-industrial revolution. And so I don't think we realize what was going on. And she kind of dove into it just a little bit. And now I'm so thankful she came up with this book, because it really expands what she talked about there, so we can understand what we're battling against and how things used to be and what we can do to restore that. So let's go ahead and dive in to The Toxic War on Masculinity, How Christianity Reconciles the Sexes. All right. In her introduction, she says simply, "But as a Christian, I had to acknowledge that what God has created is intrinsically good. It is sin that has distorted and twisted its original good creation. The real problem is not an inherent flaw in masculinity itself. It's that American society has become secularized and has lost the biblical vision of manhood. Oh, have we lost it? And it is really causing lots of trauma and issues in our everyday life here in Abilene, Texas. Compared to secular men, devout Christian family men who attend church regularly are more loving husbands and more engaged fathers. They have the lowest rates of divorce, and astonishingly, they have the lowest rate of domestic violence of any major group in America. Does that shock you? Haven't we always heard that church meant that the church is no different than the world? The evidence shows that Christianity has the power to overcome toxic behavior in men and reconcile the sexes, an unexpected finding that has stood up to rigorous empirical testing. We should be bold about bringing it to the public square." So the first chapter is called Why Can't We Hate Men? two scripts for masculinity. Okay, so I want to talk to you about this mass shooting in Thousand Oaks, California in 2018. So the killer was a 28-year-old Ian David Long. He was a college dropout, former Marine, unemployed, divorced, living with his mother. So he knew the bar had a weekly college night where it'd be crowded with young people, and he entered the bar dressed in a black hood pulled over his head. He tossed smoke grenades to create confusion and drew out a pistol and started shooting. A sergeant from the sheriff's office rushed over to help, but the shooter was waiting for him, and he killed the sergeant and 12 others. Okay, so then what happened was, then some other men grabbed the women and threw and kind of gathered them under the pool tables so that they would be protected and shielded them with their bodies. And then when they got to a place where the shooting stopped or he reloaded his gun, then they found an exit to start ushering people out of the danger area. And so what's interesting is, she says, two young men, one uses masculine strength to take lives, the other uses masculine strength to save lives. So one of the main guys, Matt, he was the kind of the ringleader of the guy that helped rescue so many people that night. And so it says here, when the American Psychological Association, the APA, issued its first ever guidelines for counseling men and boys in 2018, it denounced traditional masculinity ideology as psychologically harmful. But which of these two men, young men at the bar that night, that terrifying night exhibited traditional masculinity? Not the shooter. So the shooter came and killed a bunch of people and Matt and organized ways to save lives. And so the shooter was not the traditional masculine man. Mass murder is not what anyone considers traditional. Mass murder is not what anyone considers traditional masculine behavior, yet groups like the APA have injected the phrase toxic masculinity into the bloodstream of Americans' public discourse. The phrase has become a catch-all exclamation for male sexism, dominance, aggression, and violence. Few people are really claiming that all masculinity is toxic, yet the message men often hear is there's something inherently defective in the male character. Many men today feel discouraged, devalued, and demoralized. Okay, so when masculinity itself is portrayed as a problem, the implication is that the solution is emasculation. Did you catch that? Man, we have been doing such a disservice by trying to equalize men and women in ways that they were never meant to be equalized. Feminism has done so much hard because it's tried to make women behave and act like men, and now it's flung the other way, and it's now making men act and behave like women. It's so toxic. That is the truly toxic part. Masculine traits are not intrinsically toxic. They are good when directed to virtuous ends. In a fallen world, the lawful application of coercive force is sometimes necessary to defend the innocent. Okay, so in the play The Man, Washington, D.C. pastor Mark Batterson says, "The image of God is our original software. Sin is the virus." The challenge is to sort out which definitions of manhood are part of the original software and which are the virus, which belong to God's original design, and which are products of sin. And she goes along to talk about this. We might say societies hold two competing scripts for what it means to be a man. Sociologist Michael Kimmel highlights the contrast with an ingenious experiment. He started by asking cadets at West Point what it means to be a good man. If someone delivers a eulogy and says he was a good man, we had that in our town just recently. Let's vote for him because he's a good man. What does that mean? And I even ask, what does that mean? Not many people could really give me an example. The cadets had no trouble answering. Honor, duty, integrity, sacrifice, do the right thing, stand up for the little guy, be a provider, be a protector, be responsible, be generous, give to others. So then he says, he asked the question, what does it say when I say buck up and be a real man? The cadet shouted, oh no, that's completely different. To be a real man means to be tough, strong, never show weakness, win at all costs, suck it up, play through the pain, be competitive, get rich, get laid. Men everywhere seem to experience the tension between what they themselves define as the good man and the way surrounding cultural pressures for them to be a real man. They sense the contradiction between the software and the virus. Of course, men do not respond well to being accused of being toxic. Who would? A better course is to ask, how can we support men in aspiring to live out the ideal of good men? Of good man, because men are made in the image of God's image, Even those who are not Christian seem to understand that their unique masculine strengths are not intended to enable them to get whatever they want, but to protect those they love, to provide, sacrifice, and if necessary, fight for them. They want to provide, sacrifice, and if necessary, fight for them. That is who they were created to be. As a result, when Christians promote a biblical moral vision, the good man, they are not imposing an alien standard on men. They are encouraging them to follow their own conscience, to be uncompromising and do what they instinctively know is right. As Paul writes in the book of Romans, people everywhere show that requirements of the law are written on their hearts. Their consciences are also bearing witness, and their thoughts sometimes accusing them and other times even defending them. I mean, it's a war. They're fighting between what they know to do and what they're being told to do. And I've even struggled with it. I mean, I finally had to tell my husband one time, I was like, yeah, I want to help you, but I will never be a man. I'm going to always help you from a woman's perspective. And to me, that was so sad because I realized there are some things I cannot help. I just have to trust that God's going to show him the way and not try and make him a manly version of what I think, but to actually be the manly version that God created him to be. It was freeing and terrifying all at the same time. But let's call sexual abuse what it is. You know, because the American Psychological Association blames, you know, men on the horrific things that they did in private places that they were never supposed to do. And it's like we lump them all together. We can't do that because sexual abuse is exactly that. It's abuse. It is sin and immorality. It is not the original software. It is the virus. We should not make the mistake of equating masculinity with men's bad behavior. A biblical worldview tells us that men were originally created to live by the ideal of good man, exercising traits such as honor, courage, fidelity, and self-control. A healthy society is one that teaches and encourages a God-centered view of masculinity. Go to the next page. All right. There are signs that many boys are failing to launch. Boys are performing worse than girls at all levels of education. Starting in kindergarten, the classroom is set up to reward girls who are on average better at verbal skills and fine motor skills, like drawing and using scissors. Girl behavior becomes the gold standard, says Michael Thompson, co-author of Raising Cain, Protecting the Emotional Life of Boys. Boys are treated like defective girls. And as a school teacher, I can say, yes, it is so hard for boys to thrive in today's classroom. And it's terrible. And they're making them like it's so focused on emotions and feelings. And that is not the way men are hardwired. And it's not that they can't feel those things, but that is so emasculating to men because it's created. It's like it's created by women to make them be like women. And there's a time and a place for it, but not in the classroom. In the past, when girls did worse than boys at school, the cause was said to be discrimination. But now that boys are doing worse, that cause is said to be their own fault for being too masculine. Comedian Bill Maher says, boys are sometimes castigated for basically just being boys. Yet ironically, even as women outperform men in college, virtually every campus has a women's study department directed at deconstructing male power. Can I get an amen to that? Seriously. The Gender Equity Act, passed by Congress in 1994, has poured millions of dollars into equity workshops, training materials, and the development of girl-supportive curriculum to offset a history of sex discrimination. Today, there are four times as many scholarships designed for women as for men. Clearly, all that money and effort is paying off. But there is nothing equivalent for boys. As a result, many boys are failing to develop the traits that have historically been associated with manhood, such as responsibility, self-discipline, perseverance, and leadership. When millennials were asked which qualities they think society values in boys, most listed traits of real man: dominance, aggression, sexual prowess, stoicism, athleticism. Only 2% of boys listed honesty and morality because it's confusing, and we've told them to be real men and not the good man. These days, you cannot overlook the devastating impact of pornography on boys' idea of what it means to be a man. The average age at which a boy is exposed to porn is 9 years old. It's on his computer, on his phone, and in his video games, movies, and music lyrics. Porn is so pervasive that when a group of researchers tried to conduct a study on its effects, they were unable to find enough men in their 20s who had not watched porn to form a control group. That is so devastating. And we know why, because back to Alfred Kinsey, all children are sexual from birth. So we've been sexualizing our boys their whole entire lives, telling them that porn is okay. And it's okay to do all, it's okay to masturbate. It's okay to do all these things that just actually causes so much heartache and problems in their lives. And, you know, I've gone into that in so much detail in other books. But this is the fact, there's no way to have a control group of men who've not been exposed to porn. That's the result of Alfred Kinsey and CECUS, the Sex Information and Education Council of the United States, because they wanted everyone in fourth grade to be willing to, or to be exposed to non-traditional views on sex. Okay, so while we focus on maybe the 10% of powerful, successful alpha males, we have been blinded to the fact that on average, men are doing worse than in the past. Men are more likely than women to be homeless, to suffer mental illness, to wind up in prison, to commit suicide, to be murdered, to be addicted to drugs or alcohol. Men's workforce participation has dropped to depression-era levels. It doesn't show up in unemployment statistics because many men have stopped looking for work, and we know that to be very true even here in the big country. They are even dropping out of marriage and family. The U.S. marriage rate is plummeting, and today it's at its lowest level ever. When sociologist Michael Kimmel interviewed young men across the country for his book, Guyland, he found that many report having a difficult time making a transition to serious adult relationships, even when they want to. Why? Because of years of engaging in casual sex has left them self-centered and immature. As Pastor John Lambeth observes, many have found ways to get what they want without the commitment. This robs them of an essential part of true manhood. We've been robbing our men by saying, you know, the world is saying just, you know, one night stands. And I mean, we even got this, you know, guy pretending to be a woman saying that he doesn't even know the name of the people he hooked up with the night before. It's disgusting. It is the message that our men are hearing, and they're suffering because of it. And it's so tragic. The church has become a place where many men feel they are asked to leave their masculinity at the door. More than 95% of respondents said the words that describe Christ and his followers were terms that our culture stereotypically associates with femininity. Femininity. There we go. I got it. Third time's a charm. Like relationships, nurture, sharing, and harmony, and not terms stereotypically associated with masculinity, like competence, achievement, competition, and accomplishment. Conflict between the sexes is not the original state of human nature, but something that can be fought against, just like every aspect of the fallen world. So now we're moving to part one, the good news about Christian men. This was so encouraging. And I hope that you will, if you nothing else, take away this encouraging news about how when we bring the kingdom to our society, it blesses so many different aspects, more than we're really led to believe. Chapter 2, Progressive Patriarchs, How Christian Men Shatter the Stereotypes. Is father absence a crisis in America today? In a survey by the National Fatherhood Institute, a huge majority of respondents, 9 out of 10, answered yes. That may not be surprising, but what is surprising is what they identified as the solution: the church. One consists of men who are religiously devout, defined as those who attend church at least 3 times a month. These men shatter the negative stereotypes. They are more loving to their wives and more emotionally engaged with children than any other group in America. They are the least likely to divorce, and they have the lowest levels of domestic abuse and violence. Let me restate those findings, since they run radically counter to prevailing stereotypes. Research has found that evangelical Protestant men who attend church regularly are the least likely of any group in America to commit domestic violence. Researchers went back to the data and discovered that nominal Christians test out with far different results. Nominals are defined as those who identify with a religious tradition because of their family or cultural background, but who attend church sporadically, if at all. The word means in name only. For example, in a survey, a man might check the Baptist box because of his family background, even though he rarely attends church. It seems that many nominal men hang around the fringes of the Christian world just enough to hear the language of headship and submission, but not enough to learn the biblical meaning of those terms, like skimming the news headlines without reading the actual stories. They cherry-pick verses from the Bible and read them through a grid of male superiority and entitlement that they have absorbed from the secular guy code for real man. They manipulate scripture to justify their abusive behavior. As a result, any statistic that blends together both committed and nominal Christian men will be misleading. For example, we often hear that Christian marriages are plagued by the same rates of divorce as the rest of the population. In fact, that's one of the most frequently quoted statistics by Christian leaders today. Yet it is highly deceptive. As we saw above, regular churchgoers divorce at a lower rate than secular couples, whereas nominal couples divorce at a higher rate than their secular peers. Any number that fails to make that distinction will create a false impression. Why is it that church-going, theologically conservative family men test out as the most loving husbands and fathers of any major group in America? The key factor, sociologists discovered, is that these men have a strong commitment to the family as a foundational institution in society. They believe marriage is not primarily about individual fulfillment, but about forming a stable, loving home to raise a family. They hold to an ideal of fidelity and permanence in marriage. Wilcox and Knox found that men's emotional work is their most crucial determinant of women's marital quality, their emphasis. And who tests out as doing the most emotional work again? The answer is theologically conservative Christian men. Because they hold a high view of marriage and family, they invest more in their marriage, and their wives test out highest in marital happiness. In the New York Times Wilcox report, it turns out the happiest wives of all wives in America are religious conservatives. Fully 73% of wives who hold conservative gender values and attend regular religious services regularly with their husbands have high quality marriage. Did you catch that? Let me repeat it. The happiest of all wives in America are religious conservatives who hold conservative gender values and are married to committed church-going husbands. Church-going dads also spend more time in activities with their children, such as eating meals together, reading to them, playing games, coaching sports, attending school activities, and leading a church youth group. All told, religiously active fathers spend about 3.5 more hours per week with their children compared to secular fathers. They are also the most likely to know where their adolescents are in the afternoon and in the evenings. The submission of a wife is not the same as obedience of a child. And that's one that we have lots of conversations about. Submission, the definition, it does not mean the same thing as a child being submissive to its parents. It is a different kind of relationship that is mutually submissive. You know, we talk about that in Ephesians. It talks about that it is not that it's one-sided. It is both are being willing to submit to the other because of the dynamic relationship they have. Church-going Christian family men accepted that there would be financial consequences to putting their family first, that they would sometimes be passed over for bonuses and promotions, but they were willing to pay the daddy penalty in order to have a richer, more engaged relationship with their children. So again, you have to pay the price. You can't have it all. They tell you as a woman, you can have it all. As a man, you can have it all. No, you can't. You can have you will get passed over for promotions because you do put limitations on your willingness to work extra hours. And that's not a bad thing. Financial incentives is not the only thing that you should pursue. You want to have a strong, healthy family, and religious men are willing to recognize and do that because they value the price that it actually, they're willing to pay the financial price to order have the relationship with their family. Paul even makes a radical statement to wives and mothers that is often overlooked. In 1 Timothy 5:14, he counsels them to be managers of their home. The Greek word is the form of okotespotes, and if you look closely at the second part of that term, you will recognize a word that looks remarkably like despot. That's exactly what it means, a ruler or master. The first part, oikos, means house. Thus, despotes means master of the house, and in the New Testament, it's applied most often to men. What could Paul possibly mean when he applies the same term to wives? Clearly, he is counseling wives and mothers to wield genuine authority within their household. All right, let's scoop this one over here. All right, so part two, how the secular script turned toxic. Pioneers and Puritans, when men followed the call of duty. In the colonial era, fertility was high. The average was 7 or 8 children because children were an economic asset. They were laborers in the family enterprise, as well as for security for the parents in their old age at a time when there were no pensions or social security. The influential economic philosopher Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations noted that the value of children is the greatest of all encouragements to marriage. Women's economic indispensability served to raise their status. On one hand, a colonial woman had few political or legal rights. She did not have a separate legal existence from her husband. She could not own property in her own name or control her own earnings. On the other hand, her essential role on the farm or in the family industry gave her considerably more power in practice than in theory. Households depended just as much on women canning fruits and vegetables as men on men raising livestock and working in the fields. And that's why many women didn't necessarily want the right to vote, because they were actually content with the way the situation was, which is not a part of the history you normally hear. And you'll learn that in this book if you read the whole thing. I'm not going to touch on that much, but the home was also the original society safety net. People took care of the poor, the sick, the infirm, the aged, and the orphan in their homes. Finally, the home was a center of education. Parents taught reading and writing to their children and servants. They used the Bible as their primer to teach both reading and character education. We tend to picture colonial fathers as domineering patriarchs, austere and authoritarian. But surprisingly, a study of the literature of that period concludes, the emotion that fatherhood is predominantly associated with is love. A book titled Addresses to Young Men, 1777, describes the tender ties between a father and his children. The noted novelist Henry Fielding wrote, a tender parent repeats his life in his offspring and feels all their pleasure and pain as much as his own. Now, who is responsible for the common good? Everyone instinctively pursues their own individual good. I look out for what's best for me, and you look out what's for best for you. But who looks out for the common good? In the colonial age, that was what authority was for. A person who occupied a position of authority was called to sacrifice his own ambition to advance the good of the whole. To use his favorite word of the colonial era, he was to be disinterested, which means not pursuing his own interest. The father of the house was like the principal of the school, the lead pastor of the church, the mayor of the city, and the manager of a corporation. He was responsible for the operations of the whole. In fact, the common stereotype that the Puritans were sexually repressed in this era is far from true. They actually rejected asceticism, denial of the body, because they associated it with Catholicism, which regarded celibacy and virginity as superior states of being. Far from rejecting sex and marriage, the Puritans argued that marriage was ordained by God and should be embraced with goodwill and delight, willingly, readily, and cheerfully, as the Puritan minister William Gouge put it. So, again, we don't hear of the Puritans enjoying their life. We hear of them being way too strict and way too unhappy with all their limitations. And I believe we read The Witch of Blackbird Pond, and it creates a totally different picture. But that is not the truth. And it's okay to read books about that, but we have to know that there is another side of that story that we're not always told. Ideologue professors, let me go back to and talk about asceticism. Asceticism is where it's really ingrained in much of church culture. It's where if you sacrifice your pleasures for God, then that makes you more holy and spiritual. And that's not true. Now, there are times where God says, deny yourself, take up your cross and follow me and deny yourself pleasures. But it's not the act of denying yourself pleasures. It's the obedience of God. And so asceticism is something that I struggled with early on in my years, because I thought, well, if I live in a small house and I don't have much material things, then that will make me closer to God. And I realize it is a false dichotomy that does not encourage me to experience the goodness of God any more than if I just obeyed him and lived in a big house with lots of stuff. Now, I'm not saying, you know, we need to be excessive, but there's nothing wrong with having nice things and enjoying the blessings that God gives us, whether it's material or non-material. But to just do something because we want to be considered closer to God does not make it true. Okay, I'm moving on. Ideologue professors at our leading universities indoctrinate impressionable undergraduates with carelessly fact-free theories, alleging that gender is arbitrary, oppressive fiction with no basis in biology. All forms of abuse result from the misuse of power, writes Stephen Tracy of Phoenix Seminary. In our fallen world, those with power, typically males, will use their power to exploit and abuse those with less power, typically women and children. Thus, to describe women as weaker, as Peter does, is not to demean them, but to acknowledge the power disparity that exists between men and women. And the antidote to that disparity is consideration and respect. In the same verse, Peter commands husbands to be considerate as you live with your wives and treat them with respect as a weaker partner and as heirs with you of the gracious gift of life. With greater power comes greater responsibility, not to use it to impose one's own will, but to treat others with respect. So now we're to chapter 5, Manhood in the Machine Age, Why the Masculine Script Started Turning Toxic. Wow. Okay. This apparent simple change in the physical location of work had enormous social ramifications. So we're talking about the Industrial Revolution when men moved out of the home and into industry. The absence of the husband father broke up the little commonwealth of the household. Family industries collapsed. The integration of life and labor was lost. For the first time in American history, men were no longer working alongside their wives and children with people they loved and had moral bond with. Instead, they began working as individuals in competition with other men. The social script for men began to change. To survive in the new commercialized workplace, it seemed necessary for men to become more ambitious and self-assertive, to look out for number one. People began to protest that men were growing self-interested, ego-driven, and acquisitive. The rhetoric around masculinity began to focus on the traits that people both then and now regard in negative light. The ideal of good man was weakening its hold on men's hearts. Industrialization took place in America from roughly 1750 to 1850. To call it revolution is no exaggeration. As feminist writer Barbara Ehrenreich explains, people were wrestled from the land suddenly, uprooted from ancient security of family, clan, parish. The agrarian form of life, which had lasted for centuries, was destroyed in one-tenth of the time it had taken for the Roman Empire to fall. Some of the criticisms raised by Karl Marx, the founder of communism, were actually quite common in his day. The Communist Manifesto, 1848, Marx protested that the industrial economy leaves no other bond between man and man than naked self-interest, than calloused cash payment. It drowns all other human bonds in the icy water of egotistical calculation. It has resolved personal worth in exchange for value. And we did. We started to see that, you know, we even did it. My husband, you know, had a private practice, and it was sometimes like, you know, it's just better economic sense for me to hire a babysitter than for you to be with the kids. And that is me changing his worth for value, because there's something just more powerful about the kids being with their father than being with a person who will care for them, but not in the same capacity. And so, you know, how many times have we done that? I've done that. And sadly, I'm sure we could have had a better outcome had we chosen to stick together with making sure that men are present in our families, because that's part of the healthy balance that we've lost a long time ago. The great novelist Charles Dickinson was appalled by the dirty, unsafe factory conditions in which workers were forced to toil. In novels like Hard Times, he portrayed the wretched lives of factory workers, the heartlessness of the factory owners, and the pollution that poured from the factory smokestacks. Most of all, he castigated the utilitarian philosophy that reduced people's worth to their measurable productive output. Man, and I even did that last week. I said, you know, if you're not producing, should you be paid for it? I mean, it's so crazy how it's ingrained in every part of our society. In short, the conflict between work and family did not involve just juggling time demands, but also transitioning between two contrasting sets of character traits. Growing numbers of men, after spending the entire day being socialized into the attitudes of the workplace, began to feel awkward with their children, as if they didn't know quite how to interact with them. Recall that the Puritans condemned what they called selfish ambition, but as society grew secular, traits that the Puritans had denounced as sinful passions were elevated to the status of rational interest. As historian Barbara Epstein explains, the market system presented men with opportunities for profit. They required the aggressive self-assertion and pursuit of self-interest that Puritanism condemned. This clash of values was a major reason why men began attending church less often. It was largely trade that drew New Englanders, especially men away from the church membership and church attendance, because they were in conflict. They couldn't do both. And in all fairness, how could they reconcile the two? But the reason people in the 1800s grew so alarmed was that Up to this time, Western civilization had applied Christian principles to the workplace. Sociologist Max Weber even labeled the Western attitude toward work the Protestant work ethic, and the label has stuck. So, just lots of conflict going on all around this. Economic historian R.H. Taney explains that in a society where Christian worldview holds sway, economics is still a branch of ethics, and ethics of theology. As a result, the legitimacy of economic transaction is tried by reference less to the movements of the market than to the moral standard derived from the traditional teachings of the Christian church. And we are far from that. I mean, I think this is always important. She introduced this to me. This was actually Francis Schaeffer introduced this idea of the fact value split, where we have two places. It's also the public private. So the private is up here at the top and the public is down here. Religion and spirituality go up here, and anything not of God goes down here. It's a very convenient little tool that they've been using for years. And here it shows you the values, subjective personal preference. You keep that in your private, up here, away from the public, and down here, the facts, objective, universally valid truths. And so, you know, there's a discrepancy on exactly why the split must be, but it is there in order to keep things separate and distinct. And, you know, when people say that, you know, you need to keep God as private and as personal, they've believed into this whole fact value split. The division was not just a matter of abstract ideas, however, it also became incarnated in American social life. Industrialization led to a divide between the public and private realms. The public realm consisted of banks, factories, corporations, universities, and the state. People began to say these large, powerful public institutions should operate strictly by science, by which they meant value-free. Morality was relegated to the private sphere of family, church, and personal relationships. In other words, you can have your religion if you have emotional need for that sort of thing, but keep it to yourself in your home and church. I mean, how often have you heard that played out in the last few months here in Abilene, Texas? The idea that the public realm should be value-free was very convenient for those who wanted to throw off Christian moral constraints. The scientists, politicians, and robber baron industrialists wanted to be free from the guardrails of biblical morality. In the value-free science, historian Robert Proctor says scholars began to argue for the autonomy of their work because they wanted to render it immune to religious or moral criticism. Wow. And we, the church, just went right along with no resistance. Men were bullied into accepting the idea that secular views are objective and neutral and thus suitable for public realm, while Christian views are subjective and biased and should be quarantined in the private realm. So you can see down here, even the sacred secular split, right? And that was, man, it keyed up for so much destruction in our country. The divorce of our so-called spiritual life from our daily activities is fatal dualism. We might say the attempt to live by two contrary worldviews was causing cognitive dissonance. As historian Peter Stearns explains, the businessman was bifurcating his values, seeing one set as appropriate for business and another as appropriate for private life. After the scientific revolution, explains William Galston of the Brookings Institution, scholars decided that the study of politics must be scientific, and again, what they meant was value-free. As a consequence, political theory was no longer animated by moral vision of the common good. When Europeans crossed the Atlantic to start colonies in the New World, they bound themselves with covenant modeled on these biblical precedents. The most famous was the Mayflower Compact of 1620. Those who signed said, "They solemnly and mutually in the presence of God and one another covenant and combine ourselves together in a civil body politic." What's the difference between a contract and a covenant? Both are agreements, but the differences between them are crucial. A contract defines an exchange of goods and services, but a covenant defines a moral relationship between persons. And that makes all the difference. Social contract theory is radically out of touch with most basic human realities. And that got brought up during COVID. Oh, we have a social contract to make sure we all do whatever science tells us to. No. Yet Jean-Jacques Rousseau proposed a similar theory. His most famous book, The Social Contract, opens with a line, "Man is born free and everywhere he is in chains." By free, Rousseau meant that humans were originally and intrinsically independent, autonomous selves. Like Hobbes' mushrooms, the chains hindering our freedom were the moral ties of marriage, family, church, and community. Man, it just irritates me. You know, I don't know what I always would like to think. What would I do in those times if I lived back then, and what I stood up for it and resisted? But who knows? You know, you can't really understand how you'd respond until you're in that situation. And I responded poorly for most of the beginning of my adult life. And now I feel like I kick myself because I didn't know better early enough to start doing better. This was a momentous shift, and it did not happen overnight. Its impact can be seen, for example, in the debate over women's suffrage. Today, most history books present the fight for women's right to vote as an example of how men oppressed women and kept them down. But that's not how people defined the debate at the time. It was framed not as men's vote versus women's vote, but as individual vote versus household vote. Doesn't that shift everything? It's not against men and women. It's against individual and household. And, like, that blew my mind out of the water. And she talks about that more. Obviously, we're not going to touch base, but just on that part. Eventually, of course, women came around to supporting female suffrage. Why? The tide began to turn when the vote was expanded to universal male suffrage. That is, when men who were not responsible for a household were given the right to vote. At that point, the meaning of the vote changed. Men no longer voted as office holders responsible for the common good of a household, but only as individuals. Politics was now every man for himself. In short, women's suffrage represented a tragic erosion of women's trust in men to take responsibility for the common good, especially women's good. The favored word was not masculine, but manly. As one historian explained, the word manly carried a moral dimension. In Middle English, the word meant brave, resolute, noble, courageous, or courteous. The Declaration of Independence used the word to mean courage in resisting the tyranny of King George III. It praised the colonists for opposing with manly firmness his invasion on the rights of people. The Industrial Revolution became a watershed in the social definition of masculinity. By taking husbands and fathers out of the home, industrialization created the material conditions that made it more difficult to fulfill a biblical ideal of manhood. Men were no longer physically present enough to be fully engaged as husbands and fathers. They spent most of their time in the public realm, which was growing increasingly secular. The Industrial Revolution thus became a catalyst for the acceptance of secular views of masculinity. And so that is about halfway through the book, and it is about that time to start wrapping up. And so I just wanted to say thank you so much for listening to this and following along with me. I hope I've irritated some places in you to make you go, well, I don't know how I feel about that. Because that's what some really good books do. It's like they challenge you, but not in a way where you feel like that there's no way you can agree with it. But you're like, why didn't I understand that before? And what did you know that I haven't? Like, you know, it makes you really question and wrestle with what we know to be true and what actually is true. And that's why we do these books, because they are really important. It's really important for us to understand history and context so that we're not just blindly following along what people tell us to believe, but we are actually pursuing truth and finding nuggets that help us get to the next level and get to the next understanding and to the next place. And so we have really been lied to for a long time about toxic masculinity. And I am just as guilty. I remember when I started teaching, I would tell my boys, you know, we don't play fight. You know, we don't do that because, you know, I was a woman and I was told that, you know, we could teach boys how to be. And I felt sick to my stomach when I realized how emasculating that was to not let boys be boys and to try and force them into being what I thought they should be. And thankfully, the Lord showed me that early on in my teaching career, so I didn't do that for much longer. But it was just one of those memories that just kind of haunts me and makes me feel sick to my stomach. And so I was thankful when my son came along that I was able to help empower him to be who he was created to be in a better way. And of course, you know, I'm doing even better with my youngest son, and we're just having to learn and grow. But I do hope that you're been stirred to think about some things and maybe even read this book. But just to understand that there's so much going on that we don't know sometimes, and it affects what we're dealing with now. And so to understand the history and the background gives us the information we need in order to know how to move forward to make a greater impact in our city for the kingdom of God. So thank you for joining me for this part one of the toxic war on masculinity. And I look forward to catching up on the last part of the book at our next episode of Book by the Bite. So please make sure you subscribe and share this with your family and friends so we can get the word out and make sure they're understanding the cultural battles that we're facing here in Abilene and the big country, because if we don't understand them, we cannot effectively battle them and defeat them, because again, we're not battling people, we're battling the enemy of who stands in opposition to who God is. And so we have to know his tactics so that we can be successful to dismantle his destructive approaches to take the hearts of people for his evil purposes. And so let's see what we can do to make an impact in Abilene and the big country. And so until next time.